she, I think, walks into that audition and they realize, oh, we've been writing a show for Barbra Streisand and we didn't know it.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater. I'm Peter Elliott, and my friend Nathan LaRude is on the other end of a Zoom screen here.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I've been down a funny girl rabbit hole.
You too, huh?
Oh my God, listening to it, reading about it, remembering seeing it, thinking about Streisand's experience. So yeah, this is the continuation, obviously, of our Streisand season. And what a way to begin.
What a way to begin. I had forgotten that, they signed her for this show on Broadway when she was like 18, 19, 20. She does the film when she's 25. She's 25 years old in that film. I mean, oh my gosh, yeah. I had forgotten just how young she is and how incredibly talented. I mean, right out of the gate, this creature is. It's astounding.
Yeah. They're, and she'd been singing torch songs before then. I mean, in some ways, she'd been living in a Fanny Brice kind of world, a Florence Ziegfeld world. She found, I think, the aesthetic of that period, the big songs of that period, even the comedy of that period, to be strangely resonant for a woman of her years.
Yeah, she's a throwback already, right? She's doing cabaret shows. She wears a lot of her own clothes in the film. Irene Sheriff, the costumer, let her keep, because basically what Barbra Streisand was wearing around town was 20s and 30s, you know, vintage outfits before she was the first hipster. She was doing vintage vinyl, vintage outfits, vintage songs, and nobody knew what to do with her. Nobody, there was no context for that. Now I get that, right? Like she's a throwback. She's a hipster. But that was not a thing in the 60s when she was doing it.
Yeah, and kind of this interesting combination. I mean, we talked about this a bit in the last episode as we introduced the series, but the countercultural, like a person very much 1964. So we're just past the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We're beginning to be full on into America being divided around the Vietnam War, women finding their place, early days of gay liberation and so forth. And she strangely, I think, Streisand, is both part of the emerging zeitgeist and also with one foot firmly planted in a previous era.
Yeah, I mean, it always kind of surprises me when she'll tell a story in the autobiography about, like, going, especially early in her career, like, they go to meet Princess Margaret. I think it's maybe the opening of the Funny Girl film or something like that. And she discovers that Princess Margaret has all of her records, which is kind of tossed up off as, like, well, of course, everybody had my records. And, like, and I actually, I want to ask you, Peter, did they? Like, was she a major, my read has been that she was kind of a niche. Like, you know, people who were into the Great American Songbook, people who were into jazz, people who were Barbra Streisand, gays, loved her. People who listened to Edie Gourmet and Judy Garland and Norma Zimmer and maybe Lawrence Welk. I mean, like, how popular was she? Or was she, because she was not the Beatles. She was not Rolling Stones. She's not Janis Joplin.
For sure. And Funny Girl made a splash in a way that a Broadway show. Even like you think Hamilton and how that kind of permeated consciousness across for musical theater fans. But even more than that, it jumped a fence.
People was a chart topper, right? Everybody knew People.
Even before the show.
Before the show opened. Yeah,
she released it. And it's a strange and wonderful song. We'll talk about it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we'll talk about it.
And I mean, my impression was we knew who Streisand was. Who's Fanny Brice, right? Like,
that was not necessarily a name that people knew. That's interesting.
And the Ziegfeld era was really eclipsed by television, by movies, by all that stuff. There were some memories of it. Maybe my parents knew about Fanny Brice, but I don't think so. she wasn't, I mean, they knew about other stars of the period. So Funny Girl not only brought Streisand, it brought Fanny Brice to the fore of consciousness in my memory.
And you've seen it live. You've seen the stage production, which is significantly different in some ways from the film.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's a long time ago, a local theater production where the Fanny Brice was between audition and the run of the show, pregnant and increasingly so. And she was good.
So it just gets bigger and bigger as the run continues.
Yeah. It was an amateur local theater production shortly after rights were released, after we did Oliver. Like a lot of those shows, it had a strong, she was strong, she was good, she was funny, she was physical as you can be at 6 months pregnant anyway, which was pretty amazingly physical for her. The supporting cast, not so much. And the supporting cast actually are caricatures in a lot of ways. It really is a one-woman show, kind of in the same way, I think, that Gypsy, it belongs to Mama Rose. Yeah, you have to have everybody else, and the stronger the supporting characters are, the stronger Mama Rose will be. But Funny Girl, my memory of it, then I saw it in summer stock in Ogunquit, Maine, probably about 66 or so. Both productions forgettable for me. They're not seared in my memory like some productions are. The film is seared in my memory as being, we saw it at, and these films, you won't remember, but some of the rest of us do, when released, as I recall, had an intermission. Sound of Music had an intermission.
Sure.
It was much more of a theatrical kind of experience. You got reserved seats. There was an intermission.
People like dress up and people it was more like going to the theater.
Yeah. And the screen was big and she was fabulous. And I think it's a better movie than it is a stage play.
Yeah, that's my sense too. William Wyler, who directed the film, had never done a musical. He's legend of the Hollywood, sort of 20s, 30s, worked with all of the greats. Apparently, at least when she wrote in her autobiography, directed more actors who won Oscars than anybody before or since. He was the Oscar-winning performance director. When she found out she could get him, she jumped at it. But he's not a musical theater guy. In fact, all the musical sequences were staged by the choreographer, Herbert Rost. My sense is William Wyler turns what's kind of a subpar musical into a good film with music. It's a good film, but it's structurally not a musical in the way that the traditional kind of Broadway musicals of the 40s and 50s were being structured. I mean, if nothing, I mean, it ends with a divorce, essentially.
Right.
Nick Arnstein and Fanny. And one of the things I know we want to talk about is, like, what is this love relationship at the center of the story? It's not actually a relationship that I particularly want to root for. Nick and Fanny are bad for each other. I mean, they say that. The show is not... is pretty clear-eyed about that. But that's a weird relationship to build a Broadway arc on.
Yeah.
There's not a satisfying love story in this thing.
Well, and Ray Stark, producer of it, the owner of the rights for it,
The actual Fanny Brice's son-in-law.
Is Fanny Brice's son-in-law. Say. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so in some ways, is this a family vanity project?
Yeah, it feels very family vanity to me.
To elevate the legacy of Fanny Brice as... But if that's its intention, it doesn't do a very good job at that. I mean, I do end up in the film, thinking about when I first saw it, feeling for Fanny. But feeling more for her like a tragic figure rather than a wronged woman.
No, I agree. She is a compelling character, and some of that is Barbra Streisand, right? Like, I mean, my sense is certainly by the time she's filming the film, the character of Fanny Brice and the persona of Barbra Streisand have pretty well melded. She even talks about this. Isabel, I can't remember the last name of the screenwriter who had also written the book, basically said, I wrote, by the time I was doing the screenplay, I had Barbra in my, I knew her vocal patterns, I knew how she was, I knew her tics, so I wrote Barbra Streisand, right? Fanny Brice, the way that she shows up in the film anyway, is basically Barbra Streisand. with some particularities. And she does the Fanny Bryce shtick. You get to see, you know, the kind of moments where she tries to, although you never see her do any of Fanny Bryce's famous characters, right? Like, she never does Baby Schnooks. She, you know, like, she does a couple of Fanny's songs, and you get a little bit of a sense of the kind of the Borscht Belt shtick that Fanny Bryce did, because that's a little bit of Barbara's shtick too, right? The girl from Brooklyn who does the, you get a little bit of the sense of the shtick, but basically she's doing Barbra Streisand. That's my sense of why that role works. They give her a lot of room to be Barbara, and she takes it to the bank.
She sure does, and it's, this is a quote from Pauline Kael, but it's about Funny Lady, the sequel, but I think it's, I love the quote because I think it sums up Barbara. Streisand is in beautiful voice, as she was in Funny Girl, and her singing is terrific, too terrific. It's no longer singing, it's something else, that strident over-dramatization that turns a song into a big number. And I'm thinking of for first song in Funny Girl.
I'm the greatest star.
The greatest star. And what a song. And she turns it into, I mean, last night, the earworm in my head was stick around for the jokes, right? It's
they'll bend in half. Did you ever hear a story about the traveling salesman? 1,000 jokes, stick around for the jokes. 1,000 faces, I reiterate, when you're gifted, then you're gifted.
She delivers that pitch perfectly, right? It's absolutely the timing of it. It's quick, and it establishes. I mean, if you got to have a great opening number, I know it's not the first, but it's her first big song.
No, but structurally, it's her I Want song, right? That is Fanny's I Want song.
And that's six expressions more than all them Barrymores put together. Instead of just kicking me, why don't they give me a lift? Well, it must be a plot, because they're scared that I got such a gift. Well, I'm miffed, because I'm the greatest star. I am by far, but no one knows it. Wait, they're gonna hear a voice, a silver flute. They'll cheer each two. Hey, that kid is terrific. When I expose it. Now, can't you see to look at me that I'm a natural Camille? As Camille, I just feel I've so much to offer. Hey, listen, kid, I know I'd be divine because I'm a natural coiffer. Some ain't got it, not a lump. Clump of talent, laugh. They'll bend in half. Did you ever hear a story about the traveling salesman? 1,000 jokes, stick around for the jokes. 1,000 faces, I reiterate. When you're gifted, then you're gifted. These are facts. I got no axe to grind. Hey, what are you blind? In all of the world, so far. Greatest star.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess what she wants is for the world to see what she knows herself to be, right? Like, basically, if there's a wish here, it's I want everybody to see this, right? I want to be famous. I mean, that's really her. That's what she wants. She wants success. I think it's deeper than that. I think she wants to be seen, right? This is a woman with so, I mean, a performer certainly, but also a person with so much pent up inside of her. I mean, the way that she's kind of, I think the opening number of the show is If a Girl Isn't Pretty, right? It sort of sets up what I think is supposed to be sort of the existential crisis of this thing, which is that everybody around Fanny has told her, you're a funny girl, you're a comic, you're never going to be pretty, you're never going to get the guy. The best you can hope for is good character bits. And yet she knows that she's the greatest star. Like, she can do anything. And when Streisand sings it, she sells me on it, right? Like, I think, yeah, she, you know, Fanny Bryce is never going to get cast as Camille. That's, you know, she thinks she's a natural coffer in the song, which I think is, I mean, I think that's, which I think is designed as a bit. Streisand could probably actually do Camille, right? Like, I think that, like, I would buy her as my Lady of the Camellias, or, you know, as La Traviata or something like that. Like, she can do the heroine. She can also do Fanny Bryce. You really get a sense of the range of the performer. It is a tour de force number. It's a great I Want song in that sense, because you get a sense of what's driving this person, which is not just artistic success. She wants to be seen. And I think then it sets up well then what happens when Nikki Arnstein walks into her life and sees her in a particular way. I think not necessarily in a way that is, I mean, he doesn't actually see her any better than anybody else does, but she loves the way that she feels, right? She feels beautiful when he looks at her. And I think she finds something so enticing in the way that he, for Nikki Arnstein, she is the greatest star and she knows it. And to have that power over a beautiful man is something that she's never experienced before. I mean, it does help us understand who this person is in a really effective way.
I'm the greatest star. Like, is this kind of an ego trip? Is this Streisand blowing her own horn? Is this, as the preacher in the First Testament book, Ecclesiastes, says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Is this about vanity? Or is this about the ego strength that is needed by anybody in the performing arts, or even, you know, clergy, to present to the world a figure, a persona? I am by far, but no one knows it. Like, already sort of growing in her, inculcating in her.
Yeah, it's a great question, isn't it? I mean, there's a piece of me that wants to say, I mean, you know as well as I do that the English word vanity is probably not a good way to translate what Koheleth is saying in Ecclesiastes. Something more like ephemerality, I think, is what Ecclesiastes was talking about. Everything is ephemeral, not so much everything is a product of the ego. Although I suppose, I mean, one could maybe make that case. I mean, you're wondering if I'm the greatest star is a sign that this woman is a little bit too obsessed with her own talents. And I think, to your point, asking that question about an artist and asking that question about Barbra Streisand, who is very aware of her own power, also has a lot of anxiety around that, but knows she's got something, right, that is powerful. I mean, one way we could, she has been gifted by God with a very particular set of, with an instrument. And she knows how to effectively use that instrument. I mean, I might say, to the glory of God and the upbuilding of God's kingdom, in the context in which that's meaningful for her, which is the context of the Broadway stage or being with an audience. But this is where, you know, like, Barbra Streisand does have, I think, a quasi-mystical sense of what it means to be gifted as an artist, and then what that means in terms of how she can connect with an audience and kind of her responsibility in terms of how she stewards that gift and how she connects with an audience. I think that's where a lot of her stuff around control come in, right? She really cares deeply about what is happening. I mean, to be truthful is the most important thing for her. She at one point in the it's actually when she's talking about Funny Girl, she has this beautiful little meditation on how she learned how to read an audience doing Funny Girl night after night, you know, which, as we've talked about, is not a discipline that she loves, right? Having to show up and walk through a set performance every night, she really struggled with. But she says, I learned how to read the audience before the show even started. There were speakers in my dressing room. Every theater has them. So an actor can follow the action on stage and know when his entrance is coming up. And when they're on, they pick up any noise in the auditorium. So she says, I could hear the rustling of the audience as they came in. I could assess their personality by the sounds of the conversation as they were getting into their seats, how they responded to the overture. And she says audiences are very different. She talks about the kind of the difference between a Tuesday night audience, a Friday and Saturday night audience, when people are drunk and they want to have a good time. On matinee days, it's usually women outnumbering the men. There's a lot of chatter. She says there's a rustle of shopping bags. And she says, the audiences that I came to enjoy were the people who I worked hardest for. They were appreciative, so I felt the need to give back. If I sensed negative vibrations, I held back. More actors would have tried to win them over. I didn't. And she says, like, audiences are truth barometers. I think it's in the next session. Audiences know the difference between a real moment and something that's being manufactured. She says, there's no point in trying to fake it. There are actors who can. I don't know how. An audience can tell the difference. They just do. I've always had great admiration for an audience. Individually, they may not be the smartest person in the room, but collectively, they are brilliant. I used to say they were like a barometer measuring the truth. So she feels very much, I think, in touch with her audiences. She feels a responsibility to her audience. She respects them. If they are coming on board like open and willing to go with her, she can work with them. If they're closed off to her, she's not gonna, right? Like, she dusts her feet off and moves on to a new town. I mean, she is almost a disciple in that sense. There's something very mystical to me about her approach to performing. And I think I'm the Greatest Star picks up on some of that, right? That the song is written in the voice of Fanny Bryce, who is performing. She's doing shtick, right? She wants to make an audience laugh. Barbara Streisand, I think, actually is not that concerned with making you laugh. Barbara Streisand wants to make you cry, right? Like, she wants to cry. And absolutely, she wants to make sure that when she is crying, it's real tears because she's feeling something. And she thinks, yes, that when she is actually feeling something, you can feel that. And I want to say, like, I think she's right. I think that is that's my sense a little bit of what it is to be a preacher and to be in connection with a congregation, right? We're similarly, right? Like, you do learn how to read a room, and you learn kind of how, like, where people will let you take them. And you can, you know, it's like, and when a congregation is like, is willing to go somewhere with you, you know, you kind of warm them up a little bit, you get them to laugh, you know, there are tricks. Stick around for the jokes, right? Like, you know, I'm with, as Camille, I just feel, but, you know, like, when I'm doing the Borscht Belt shit, I mean, there are tricks, I think, that a performer learns, that a preacher learns, in terms of how to get people, yes, to feel safe enough in your hands, where then, I used to have a preaching professor would say, if I can make you laugh in the first, you know, like, minute of a sermon, I can get you to cry by the end of it. And it is a trick, it's a gimmick. But I think it's in service to, I think, like Barbara says about audiences, congregations can tell when a priest, a pastor, a preacher is not in the moment, right? Kind of trying to promulgate doctrine that they feel, right, that they ought to say. This is the sermon here, right? This is what I think you ought to know. And you can tell when somebody doesn't really believe it, right? When they're just sort of like quoting you the church line as a way of like kind of hiding really behind the doctrine. I think congregations have an unerring sense of what's real and what's not from a preacher. And I love that Barbara brings that sense of authenticity to her role as a performer. That makes really, so in that sense, like, I'm the Greatest Star, I think, could be, you know, it's like any preacher with a healthy ego could probably sing a version of this, right? Like, we all think we're the greatest preacher.
Yeah. Well, and when you and I teach musical theater, we always talk about the various ingredients, you know, the book, the songs, the lyrics, the performers, but then always the most important part that makes a piece of musical theater work or not work is the audience's response. They are an essential, yep, part of, in the same way that a congregation, a sermon preached, right, without, it's a congregation,
yeah,
you know, yeah, is nothing, right? So it's this interplay, and into all that comes this notion, I mean, Jesus talks, like in the Sermon on the Mount, for example, a lot about hypocrites or play actors. The notion that an actor puts on a mask in the ancient world, literally put on a mask, and was someone else, and then there was somebody else behind. And Barbara wants to smash that convention in a kind of iconoclastic 1960s sort of thing. If, as you say, she wants to cry. She wants to laugh. She wants the authenticity. And we're back to method acting, which we talked about last time. And I think the same thing applies to preaching, which makes You Are Woman, I Am Man, which is a problematic song that we need to talk a bit about the heteronormativity of it. But what made, I think, her run on Broadway so difficult was the actor playing Nicky Arnstein was the son of Charlie Chaplin, Sidney Chaplin, handsome, good-looking dude who wanted to have an affair with Barbara, according to her autobiography.
I think they started sleeping together, and then she ended
they
it.
Did. And yeah. then they didn't. Yeah. And then he was
horrible
on stage to her. Horrible. Calling her names, hitting her. And I think it gives us a window into the before Me Too movement and early feminists. She was being abused on stage, at least as she tells it. And it's such an, when I heard her interviewed on NPR, just as the book was being published, this was a story that she told on the air. It clearly has left scars in her. understandably so. And my point is, she was not believed.
It went all the way to like a court. I mean, a version of a court hearing in front of Actors Equity. I mean, like, it was a lawsuit. And they were all men, apparently, and they all sided with Sidney that he had done nothing wrong. She was completely she was not believed. So she just had to deal with it.
Right. Yeah. So knowing that and hearing her and Sidney Chaplin, sing this song on the recording, and I didn't know this before reading the autobiography, right? It suddenly makes that song kind of creepy.
Well, the whole relation, I mean, and Nikki Arnstein's got a couple other, and actually Fanny does too. There is a, the way that relationship is presented, at least the words that they give to Fanny Bryce, some of them are songs that the actual Fanny, you know, it's like My Man, right? So that's a song that was written for the actual Fanny Bryce. I don't, you know, it's not fair to how much of that is actually based in her relationship to Nikki Arnstein, not necessarily, but the way it's used in the film, it absolutely is, right? That is Fanny's song about Nikki.
Absolutely.
And there's other material too. You know, The Music That Makes Me Dance is the song that didn't make it into the film. That kind of functions like My Man in the stage show. And it's basically all about, like, he's the best thing. I want to lose myself in the eyes of this guy. I mean, and that's kind of You Are Woman, I Am, right? Like, Nick's kind of invitation is basically be a part of me, right? Like, I will take the lead in this thing. And the way the material is presented, you are to believe that Fanny is intrigued by that. And to a certain degree, I can buy that, right? Like, who doesn't, you know, like, in the eyes of somebody as different from her as he is, he's so sophisticated, he understands the world in a particular kind. I mean, he represents so much to her in terms of, like, what she thinks she wants out of life. And his invitation is basically, like, let me drive this relationship. He's threatened by her success, he's threatened by her, the fact that she has more money than he does. There's a whole kind of fragile male ego thing at work in this. Like, her job is to soothe him. In fact, I think her mother even says to her in the film, right? Like, he needs a helper. He needs a wife, Fanny. He doesn't need, you know, I don't know what exactly she says. But, like, you know, she doesn't need you to fix the problems. He needs you to support him as a wife, right? Like, basically sublimate yourself.
This is patriarchy.
You are woman. I am man. You are smaller, so I can be taller than. You are softer to the touch. It's a feeling I like feeling very much. You are someone admired. Still, our friendship leaves something to be desired. Does it take more explanation than this? You are woman, I am man. Let's kiss.
This is patriarchy. As unvarnished, really, you know, you are woman, I am man, you are smaller, so I can be taller. Yeah, you are softer to the touch, you know, this whole man is hard, woman is soft, man is dominant, woman is submissive. It rehearses all the tropes in the song. And apparently, if I'm remembering the autobiography right, it was originally just his song. And she was going to be there. And then she added in this very clever counterpoint, you know, how many girls become a sinner while waiting for a roast beef
dinner.
Would
a convent take a Jewish girl? Which is a great line.
How many girls become a sinner while waiting for a roast beef dinner? Though most girls slip in ordinary ways. I got style, I do it bordelais. Well, at least you think I'm special. You ordered a la carte. It's a feeling I like feeling very. I feel the feeling down to my toes. Now I feel that there's a fire here. Oh, try that once a little higher, dear. What a beast to ruin such a pearl. Would a convent take a Jewish girl?
Do you suppose he wants his dinner back, etc.? Yeah. And I think by doing that kind of counterpoint, and by inserting it into what Ray Stark wanted to kind of have Fanny Bryce, I think, be the little woman and Nick Arnstein the big man, and the big man betrays the little woman, and that's the tragedy. Instead, I think she kind of emerges, Streisand kind of emerges the character of Fanny Bryce as much more of a sparring partner, much more of a wanting to be equal, wanting to have her voice heard over this domineering
love ballad.
In the case of Sidney Chaplin, so
abusive,
totally domineering, abusive dude to a playful relationship, which is much more intriguing and attractive.
It's not quite Baby It's Cold Outside. In other words, it's not exactly a song about date rape because we get to hear her part of it. And at one point, I think she does say like, oh, a little lower, dear, right? Like he's like licking her ear or something like that. So you do get the sense that she's not in control of the situation, but to a certain degree, she is consenting to it, right? She likes it when he licks her ear. And that to me, actually, I mean, like that's what keeps this from being a really problematic song about a rape. She is being manipulated for sure. She's being gaslit in a certain kind of way. And she likes the attention. And physically, she likes what he does to her body. So there is a piece of me that wants to, I don't want to lose that part of the story. The part where, and you know, in the film, the next scene is them like she's eating a huge plate of lobsters on a dock in Baltimore. And you know, like this woman is ravenous. The guy even says like, lady, I've never cooked four lobsters for one person. She's like, put the water on again, right? Like, I mean, he opens up in her hunger, physical hunger. I think some of that is like, she's having sex for the first time. It's like he rocks her world. There's a piece of me, it's like, I remember the first time that, it's like, I recognize that, right? Like when your body comes alive for the first time. So I don't want to lose that part of Fanny. I think that's a really important, that tells us something really important about the character, the way it's being presented in the material, right? This is a woman who has been starved for physical affection, to be beautiful, to be loved. She finally has it. I want to see that part. And You Are Woman, I Am Man is setting that up for us. And it also sets up for us all of the ways in which this relationship is doomed from the start. Just the way he treats her, the way he sees her, the way that he thinks he can manipulate her to get what he wants. And then that she'll just kind of go away into a little box and he can go off and have his life and she'll be there when he gets home to... I mean, this is kind of Henry Higgins and Eliza, right? Like, where the devil are my slippers? It is basically, to a certain degree, it's like it's every male-female relationship in musical theater and in the movies from about... with some notable exceptions.
Carousel, like, this is a trope we know. On it goes. Even the King and Anna, you know. And one of the interesting things that I think about with Funny Girl is how the character that Streisand played, Fanny Bryce, and Barbara Streisand became kind of inseparable for a way. Was she playing herself? Because when you read her autobiography, her upbringing, she wasn't supported to move into the theatrical world. She had a difficult time breaking in because she's doing something different, kind of like Fanny Bryce.
Her mother was kind of horrible to her. Actually, Fanny's mother is a lot better than the actual Barbara Streisand's mother was, I think.
Yeah. And then her Streisand's own absolute commitment to authenticity makes me so, Streisand, the actor, didn't have to, but did have an affair with Sidney Chaplin, the Nicky Arnstein character.
And then with Omar Sharif, too.
He becomes abusive on stage, but then he becomes kind of abusive on stage. It's kind of like art imitating life, imitating art here with her, with this role in particular, which she did over and over again.
Of what drew her to the... I mean, you know, they tried to develop the project. You've done a little bit of rabbit-holing down, like, where the material comes from. Stephen Sondheim was going to do it with Julie Stein. They originally were optioning Mary Martin. I think Mary Martin was the first person to say, you got to have a Jewish girl for this. Like, and, you know, they kept hearing this over and over. They were going to do it with Carol Burnett. She said the same thing. You need a Jewish girl for Fanny Bryce. I'm not doing it. There was another... Oh, Anne Bancroft. They developed a lot of material with Anne Bancroft. And then apparently Julie Stein played her the music and she's like, yeah, no, I'm not singing those songs. Like, I mean, but yeah, you imagine like what is the Funny Girl That Never Was with Stephen Sondheim lyrics as a vehicle for Anne Bancroft? I mean, what an interesting way to think about this thing. But over and over, they keep hearing, you need a Jewish girl to do this. So they come to, you know, Julie knows Barbara Streisand. They talk with her about it. And I think what drew her to the part initially was thinking about all the ways in which she and Fanny Brice are similar, right? They're both Jewish girls from Brooklyn. They're both not classically good looking, right? Like, she even talks about, right, like, my face is bad for the screen. My eyes are too far sunk in. I've got a weird bump on my nose. I mean, she says, ironically, they had written all of the musical material in Funny Girl about Fanny's nose before I was ever involved in the project, right? Like, she I think, walks into that audition and they realize, oh, we've been writing a show for Barbara Streisand and we didn't know it. And she says, you know, we had similar taste in clothes. We had similar tastes in colors. We liked the same jewelry. She listened to some interviews, I think, that Fanny Brice had done before the end of her life. And it was her doorway into the character, right? I think she felt like she was hearing her own voice coming back at her. They were both into interior decoration. They were into the same kinds of looks. And she says, we were also into the same kinds of men. Dark, good-looking boys with great teeth. That's Barbara Streisand's type. It's also Fanny Brice. I mean, Elliot Gould is, I mean, as this thing is happening, he's like... who has a gambling, good teeth and a gambling problem. He basically is Nick Arnstein. I mean, there is a way in which this funny girl becomes so prophetic in terms of what she is dealing with and then is going to be dealing with as a strong woman with a lot of power who is attracted to men who don't really know what to do with a woman who is more successful, makes more money, and is frankly more talented than they are. I think that becomes kind of so there is a way in which Fanny Brice and Barbara Streisand, certainly by the time the movie is being filmed, are essentially fused. She is doing the persona of Barbara Streisand. I think she would be the first person to say, you know, what you get on stage when I am being Barbara Streisand is a character I am playing. That is not who I am in my bathtub. That is not who I am at home with James Brolin. I am giving you a character, but that character is essentially kind of in, we see it kind of in formation in Funny Girl. It is who she is, the persona that she is. We might say, you know, this is kind of taking it back to Jesus again, right? Like, this is her mask. And then every once in a while, I know you want to talk about my man. I think there are moments where that fusing, because she's a method actor, you actually, I mean, my sense is you get a little bit of a sense of Barbara, like the actual person, the hurting human child, Barbara Streisand. And I think one of them is My Man, which she insisted on performing live. Every other song in the film is pre-recorded. She had to lip sync to it, which she hates. But My Man, they watched it in dailies and she said, I know I can do this better if you let me sing it live. And that's what they filmed, is a live performance of her singing My Man. And you talked about that, like seeing it for the first time in the theater.
Oh my God. It was, I remember actually, the thing I remember about it, it's a brilliant performance. I just watched it again this morning and compared it against Fanny Brice's rendition. And, you know, back to Pauline Kael, her singing is terrific. It's no longer singing. It's something else. It's an over-dramatization that turns a song into a big number. My Man, when Fanny Brice sings it, doesn't feel like a big number. It's a sad number. She brings some drama to it, but she's a comedic actress.
But I love him. I don't know why I should. He isn't good. He isn't true. He beats me too. What can I do?
Streisand singing it. So, as you say, she's singing it live. She's in a black dress on a black background. You've just witnessed this trajectory of a relationship where she is hurt. Her world has come apart. And, you know, those of us who have loved and lost know the grief that comes when a hoped-for relationship comes to an end. It's inconsolable would be a word, you know, for a period of, it's grief. It's deep grief. And she channels all of that into my man at the end. I think Liza Minnelli's Cabaret at the end of the movie Cabaret, she does a similar thing. But Streisand emotes. It's a shorter song. She doesn't sing the verse. She kind of goes right into the chorus. My memory is her image filled on the big screen, tears streaming down her face. And back to your point, she wants the audience to cry. I wept as a kid.
Oh, my man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just despair. But I don't care. When he takes me in his arms, the world is bright. All right. What's the difference if I say I'll go away? When I know I'll come back on my knees someday. For whatever my man is, I am his forevermore.
And it touched and moved me. I remember driving, we were in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, driving back up to Wells, Maine, where we were vacationing, and looking out the back window and seeing the stars in the sky. And just in that kind of way that sometimes you have when a performance has so touched you that it's still with you, you know, I was still in the emotional grip of that performance.
Yeah.
I was in the afterglow of it, feeling, what was I, 12, 13, something like that. Feeling feelings I didn't even know what those feelings were.
Isn't that fascinating? I mean, I feel like that to me is, like, that's the doorway into understanding. I mean, certainly why she is such a queer icon. A 12-year-old gay boy watching that performance on screen, and my sense is feeling seen in a certain kind of way.
Yeah. Even though the language of it, now listening to it.
Yeah, it's a kind of disgusting song.
All my life is just despair, but I don't care when he takes me in his arms, you know. Again, we're back to heteronormativity. And the myth of romantic love, I think the dangerous myth of romantic love, the idea that there is one person out there for you and your soul connects with them, and you know, what you and I have probably witnessed at countless weddings that we have done with young couples who are in the blush of falling in love, the bubble that you're in that does not sustain.
It's why you should never let couples write their own vows, because what they're going to try to vow is like, sweetheart, you don't want to say that.
No, you can't do that.
Stick with the church's vows. They're much more responsible.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, a couple who said to me, why do we have to say till death do us part? We want to be together after death. And I said, no.
Do you really?
No, you don't. You might want to think about that. But she is, I mean, my man, the lyric is all in that romantic, the myth of romantic love, which isn't to say that, I mean, I believe in love. I believe in lifelong, long-term partnerships, all of that stuff. Don't misunderstand me. But I think there is a dangerous myth there.
Yeah. Well, the song is basically, I know he's bad for me and I don't care. When he takes me in his arms, you're right? Like, what's the difference if I say I'll go away when I know I'm coming back someday? For whatever my man is, I am his, right? Like, it's basically, what's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad?
I was just going to say.
It's Julie Jordan, yes.
He's my fella, and I love him.
And I love him.
That's all there is to that. You know, common sense may tell you, yeah.
And at one level, it's like, I'm like, oh, gross. Like, again, really? And at another level, I mean, kind of like you being 12 years old in the back, right? Like, it is, I recognize that, right?
I recognize
it in myself. I recognize it in the people around me. I think mostly kind of women are taught that kind of script, right? That this is what you should be looking at. And if he's, you know, if nothing's perfect, so don't expect him to be perfect. Like, massage his ego, make him feel like a big guy, keep him around, because having him is better than not having him. And if there is a triumphant story in Funny Girl, I think maybe the stage show does this a little bit, you know, because the stage show ends with her singing Don't Rain on My Parade to her mirror, like, and it's a kind of, you know, it's slightly updated lyrics where it's like, okay, here we go. I'm gonna walk back into life again.
I
want to
live and live now.
I want to live again.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one level, it's like, wait, is this her song of resolve that she's gonna fight to get him back? Or, and this is actually, I think, what Funny Lady picks. The only thing that I like about Funny Lady is it tells us a story about Fanny Bryce finally saying to Nick Arnstein, no, I'm over you. You were never that great for me to begin with. Or maybe you were, whatever. I was complicit in that. But I don't need you anymore. I have found out who I actually am. And I actually, like, that's, if there's a death and resurrection story, if there's a gospel story in this thing, that's the story I want to hear in Fanny Bryce, where she's not, like, pining for her man and doesn't care how badly he treats her because she knows, like an abused dog, she's going to go back and lick up his vomit again. I want a story about somebody who's like, nope, I'm worth something. I am enough. You know, if Billy Rose comes into my life and we can figure out a great partnership, great. That's sort of the story that Funny Lady tells, her marriage to the great Billy Rose. Which was not, you know, she said, I fell in love with Nick Arnstein. I fell in like with Billy Rose, right? So it's not the grand passion of youth. It's much more adult in a certain kind of way. It's a negotiated relationship. I think that's actually, I mean, as somebody who's like in my mid-40s, that's a story I'm very interested in hearing right now. Thank you very much.
Yes.
But yeah, that to me is, and I think, you know, in the way that, in the person of Barbara Streisand, I can catch echoes of that other story in the way that she does My Man, right? At the end of the thing, it is kind of a moment of triumph, right? When she's got her hands out, you know, it's like, it's dark triumph, it's heartbreaking triumph, but it is not a moment of defeat.
Right.
And that's right. Because of the way that Barbara Streisand plays that moment. It's because she's Barbara Streisand playing the great Fanny Bryce, and you know, right? Like, nobody's going to try to fucking rain on that parade, right?
Right.
That parade is going to go forward no matter what.
Well, I think it's William Wyler's brilliance in the way that he shot that and in letting the film kind of end with Streisand filling the screen, filling our hearts. It's the right way to end the film. And she just sells that song.
She sells the number.
And watching it again, when I watched it just before we went on mic this morning, her emotion, I mean, there's tears streaming down her face. It just pushes out. But yeah, Don't Rain in My Parade. I always connect Don't Rain in My Parade with Before the Parade Passes By, which we'll talk about next episode with Hello Dolly. Here we've got two songs about the excitement of parades in New York City. And you've lived in New York. You've experienced the smell of the crowd, you know,
the roar of the grease paint, the smell of the crowd.
but this, in some ways is Don't Rain in My Parade a feminist anthem? Like, I'm going to live and live now, get what I want, know how. And then of course, then she goes into Nicky Arnstein. I mean, it seems to be all about that, but it's about more than that, is it? I don't know.
It is about more than that. Yes, it's the Act One closer number, so I structurally I need it to be about more than that. Yeah, at the surface, it's like, don't, you know, I'm going to go chase after my man, basically at the expense of my career. Everybody's telling me not to do this. I probably just lost my job with Florence Ziegfeld, but I'm going to, you know, I care enough about this. So at one level, like, what a dumb choice, girl, because, like, it's not going to, but whatever. I think you're right. I think it is, like, nobody gets, because underneath it, it's like, nobody gets to tell me what's right for me, right? I will be the one to decide. I may fuck this up. And that's what she said, right? Like, I got one shot, and if, you know, and at least I didn't fake it. And hand me my hat, sir. Guess I didn't make it. So she does kind of set up for you, I'm going to shoot really high. I will probably fail, but I will not fake it. I am gonna write her commitment. And this is Barbara Streisand more than it is Fanny Bryce. My commitment is to authenticity, my commitment is to truthfulness. That starts with my own sort of interior sense of, I know what's right for me. I know myself better than anybody else knows me. So I am gonna fight for my own choices, and nobody gets to tell me. So at that level, yeah, I think it is a song about self-empowerment.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to sir, I guess I didn't make it. But whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection, a freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once. Right, sir. Ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see I'm gonna have my bite.
And, I mean, what's coming to my mind is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, film about the same time. Catherine Ross brings home Sidney Poitier to parents Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And she loves Sidney Poitier. They are a white upper middle class family. They don't want a black man as part of their family. And that's what the film goes on about. So it's a civil rights movie. It's a great movie. But the point is, I think that what's similar is this self-empowerment. I'll make my own choices. 1964. She sings that, and she, Streisand now, not Fanny Brice, does make her own choices. She sings the song she wants to sing. Her career trajectory is her own unique way of coming at things. Nobody is going to rain on her parade. Nobody's going to rain on her parade.
No. And that, I mean, that song has become so like iconically associated with her, but it is, it's such a, it's a primal cry of, I mean, like, yeah, empowerment, release. I mean, you think about that famous shot, you know, where they're on the tugboat, right? Statue of Liberty shot. I mean, the fucking Statue of Liberty. I mean, they're layering this stuff on as thick as... And I am here for it all. Like, that
It's a brilliant moment.
It's a brilliant moment. It's one of my favorite, staged numbers for... You know, like, I just think that... And that's all Herb Ross. That's not William Wyler. That's all Herb Ross directing the hell out of that number. It really, really works. It's a great moment in film.
So people. Before we finish, we need to talk about people.
So is people. It really true? She apparently went to Bob Merrill, the writer of that lyric at one point, and she said, only half kidding, isn't it people who don't need people who are the luckiest people in the world? Which I think is her way of telling us the autobiography, like, I don't really know what this song's about. Nobody really, like, Bob Merrill, I don't know if I want to call him an unsuccessful lyricist. He's doing something very interesting as a lyricist, which is giving strange, unspecific, almost elliptical Zoan cone-like lines. That it's like, what does that mean? People who need people are the luckiest people in the world. We're children needing other children and yet letting our grown-up pride hide all the... I'm going by memory
here. Like,
we're all really vulnerable. We're all basically kids, but we try to pretend we don't need each other. I think that's what he's saying.
People who need people are the luckiest people in the world. We're children needing other children. Lovers are very special people.
But then it's like, lovers are very special people. And then it does pivot to, what, as you say, that kind of toxic, you know, with one person, one very special person.
A feeling deep
feeling
in your
deep
soul.
In your soul says you were half, now you're
now
whole.
Now you're whole.
No more hunger and thirst. But first, so like one way I can think is like, is this just in praise of extroverts? Like as an introvert, I want to say like, I mean, I'm a little more with Barbara. Isn't it people who don't need people who are the luckiest people in the world? Like, that's a song I'm very interested in hearing someone sing, maybe not. It does sort of feel to me like a sort of I mean, if I'm being cheap to it, a kind of a hymn to neediness. And yeah. I don't know that I like that, frankly. I like the song.
I mean, it's a great song. It almost was cut from the show. She recorded it before. It shot to the top of the charts. I think it's one of those songs that's better because she sings it.
Yep.
Right? I think it's her interpretation, whatever she found within her to connect with that song. I mean, irreverently around the house, I do it as the cannibal song. People who eat people, you know. Children eating other children drives my husband crazy.
It's Sweeney Todd, just a couple of years ahead of his time, right? But, more hot pies!
They all deserve to die.
They all deserve to die.
Yeah, I don't know. And how do you explain the popularity of it? That's the other...
That's my question. That's what I mean, here again, I'm actually going to ask an actual question of somebody who was there. Why was this song such a hit? Is it her? I mean, like,
I think
there is a way
her.
In which the melody and the way that the... the lyric works for her, not because it says anything particularly interesting or even, like, intelligible, but because those syllables show off her voice so well.
Yes.
People who need people. I mean, like, the way that she can use those P's, those vowels. I think we have the second.
Lovers are very special people.
Very special people.
I mean, like, it's where you start to hear Barbara Streisand the parody. Right? She's almost doing her own, a drag performance of her own drag character. I think because she was going to become such a juggernaut, when she first recorded it, nobody knew she was going to become a juggernaut. But it is distilled Barbara Streisand, that sound that she produces on that song. So that's my best argument as to why People became a phenomenon.
I mean, similarly, why did Send in the Clowns become Stephen Sondheim's greatest hit? It's actually a very simple melody. It's hymnic almost in its character. And I think its obliqueness.
It can almost mean anything.
What does it mean? What does this mean? Send in the clowns. When you see A Little Night Music, you know what it means. It functions beautifully within the show. In Funny Girl, it almost feels like it's a moment out. You know, we've got the plot going on. Okay, now Barbara's going to sing People. And then we'll carry on.
Because that's her big hit. And then we'll carry on. Well, it's their love. I mean, if we're going to go back to the relationship between Nick and Fanny, which I have pretty well lambasted, it is, I maybe want to say, like, maybe the one moment of authenticity between these two characters, certainly, right? Like, she is telling him something about herself, I think, which is, like, both, like, I need people, I need an audience, I need somebody to perform with. I mean, in the context of the show, like, they've just come from her mother's saloon, she's taken him back to this party, and he's like, oh, you know, you better go back into all of your, you know, all the people of Henry Street back in there. And I think a little bit of the immediate sense of the song is, I need all those people, right? Like, they are the ones who have, it's Mrs. whatever her name is who told me I wasn't pretty, and I, you know, like, I had that voice in my head. It's also, like, my own mother who's been in nothing but supportive of me and always believed that I could do anything. I need those people. And then she sort of turns to him, who represents a completely different world, right? He's sophisticated, he's wealthy, he's all the things that she isn't. And it's kind of her way of saying, like, I think I kind of need you too, or I'm at least falling in love with you. Like, I can't be alone in a room. There's too much of me. I need an audience, whether that's an actual audience who's paying to see me perform, or someone in my life who can actually see underneath my hypocrisy, the mask I'm wearing, and love the real, very vulnerable, scared child who thinks she's not pretty and not lovable. I need people. So at that level, it's like, yeah, Fanny, it is an anthem to neediness. It's Fanny saying, like, be very careful with my heart, because it's a pretty tender thing. And, you know, Nick mostly just listens. But at the end, you know, it's like they do have this lovely moment where he kisses her and then he says, okay, I'm, you know, going off to gamble now and I won't see you for a year. And she, you know, like, sends him off into the night and she hums. So it's, I don't know. There is something very sweet to me about Fanny letting herself be that vulnerable with Nick. Barbara letting herself be that vulnerable with her audience. I think there's something truthful in what's being said there. Although, as we've said, the lyric is odd and elliptical at best.
Yeah. I wonder just, you know, whether part of the appeal is this deep sense of needing... I mean, the song ends up being about one person, one very special person. But whether it's really about we need community. We're social animals. And there's no getting apart. You can you cannot live life alone, really. Not in terms of partnership, but in terms of we are. I mean, it's Mbutu, as Desmond Tutu would talk about.
Right.
I am because you are. We only know each. We only know ourselves in relationship, and we are most alive. And I'm not talking about romantic relationships. I'm really talking more about community. About and I think it's one of the values that church at its best can give people is an experience of the joys and the sorrows and the frustrations and the maddening craziness of being with people, because we need each other. We are not, and I'm not talking about introversion, extroversion, I'm not talking about partnered, not partnered. I'm talking about, I guess, in theological terms, the body of Christ, you know? And I don't mean the body of Christ as Christian religion. I'm thinking of the body of Christ as all human beings. And whether that, whether there's some a kind of universal theme about people who need people, I mean, is like every people, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense of the kind of the last line to me, right? Like, you know, because the second verse is all about the romantic partnering, right? Lovers are very special people. But she's, you know, no more hunger and thirst. But first, in other words, before you go looking for romantic love, first be a person who needs people, which actually is kind of, I mean, next door to a theological treatise, right? Get in touch with the fact that you can't do, you can't live life on your own. You are, by virtue of being a person, a created being, you rely on other created beings. I mean, this is basically Ubuntu, right? Like, embrace that fact, learn to, and then, you know, sure, right? Like, find romantic love where it finds you. Oh, my man, I love him so he'll never know. That sometimes blows up in your face. But the fact that at the end of the show, Fanny Bryce is still a person who needs people, right?
Yeah.
Like, that fact hasn't changed.
Well, in connecting that to her autobiography, now that, as you said that, I was thinking, yeah, her autobiography is really about her relationships. It's about the people that she's worked with.
Well, her relationships and her clothes, but yes.
And her
but
clothes,
first, be a person who needs clothes would be another way.
Fair
there's
enough.
A drinking game. There's a drinking game to play with this autobiography where every time she says "on pure waste," you take a shot and you're drunk with. Well, it's 48 hours long. It's a whole weekend of. It's the lost weekend with Barbara. But yes,
yeah,
no, I think your point is well taken.
Relationship after relationship after relationship, whether it's romantic partners, occasional lovers. Directors,
other actors, artistic collaborators.
It's really about really not some. I mean, her thoughts are in relationship to people.
Yeah,
her thoughts aren't kind of abstract philosophical wonderings. They're about situations. They're about people. Yeah.
She is both the greatest star. And she's a person who needs people. And those are two, that's kind of a, I mean, like, I just think about, as you say, the autobiography in some ways is both of those things, right? What do you do when you know you're the greatest star and you know, I mean, to a certain degree, or at least you believe that, like, you know, you can do your own makeup, you should do your own hair, you should wear your own clothes, you should orchestrate your own material, you choose your own material, you should be your own director, light designer, or like, you know, she's a one woman, she wants to do it all.
She's a juggernaut.
She's a juggernaut, and she is the greatest star. She knows how you know, right? Like, she thinks her choices are better than all of her collaborators, unless they're William Wyler, and, you know, she actually learns to trust them. And, as you say, she really needs people in her life.
Yeah. And that's the through line.
Yeah. Kind of beautiful,
well,
in a way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess we're the luckiest people in the world, eh?
I guess so.
Next episode on to Hello Dolly, I think.
Yeah, before the parade passes by. Another parade.
Until then.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @GospelofMT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time.